And this is Jim Kircher from the Nine Network, filling in for Don Marsh today. And joining me is David Nassau, author of The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy. Thanks for coming in today. It was a remarkable and turbulent life, wasn't it?
It certainly was.
You know, baby boomers know Joseph Kennedy, if they know him at all or first got to know him, as the father of John and Bobby and Teddy. And that's also partly the remarkable and turbulent and tragic part of his life. But Joseph Kennedy was quite a figure even without that, going back to, well, let's say the 20s, I guess.
One of the reasons why I so enjoyed writing this book was that I'm a historian, and I could tell the history of so much of the 20th century through this man's life, from the Great War, in which he works as a shipbuilder in Boston, through the 20s and the rise of in Hollywood, from the silence to the talking pictures, to the New Deal, to the stock market booms and busts, to London in the run-up to World War II, when he was the ambassador to Great Britain from 38 and 40, to World War II and the Cold War and the New Frontier and electing his son President of the United States.
There's an awful lot, and I think we're going to hear from some of the callers this morning. So join us this morning at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Email is talk at stlpublicradio.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter at STL On Air. One of the things about Joseph Kennedy is, I will say, the misconceptions, the myths, that still exist to this day, although you note that some of those are based in fact, but not necessarily all in fact. What are some of the most common myths that still survive, and how do we explain what the reality is here?
Well, you know, when you begin, when I undertook this project and I told people I was working on Joseph Kennedy, everybody said, oh, that bootlegger. They often said, oh, that blankety-blank bootlegger. So we begin with that, and I would have been very happy as an author if he had been a bootlegger, because then I could have written about Momo Giancana and the mob and some colorful characters. He was not a bootlegger in any way, shape, or form. He provided his Harvard class with booze for their reunion, the 10th reunion in 1922, but that was it. That was it. I checked out every source, every rumor, every innuendo, and they all vanished into air. They were all second and third hand and fourth hand. The only hard evidence that he had ever been a bootlegger was the story of a Joseph Kennedy Limited, a Vancouver liquor importer who snuck booze across the border from Canada to the United States during Prohibition and didn't pay his excise tax. Canadian government didn't care if you snuck booze into the United States, as long as you paid your taxes. This guy didn't pay his taxes, but it was not my Joseph P. Kennedy. It was a David Joseph Kennedy of Vancouver.
I have to give my father credit, because he told me many years ago that one of the ways Joe Kennedy made money was cornering the market on legal importation at the end of Prohibition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Your father was a smart man.
I don't know where he got that.
Well, you know, when Prohibition is over, Kennedy knows that Americans are, it's easy to make gin. You can manufacture gin and sell it the next day. Scotch has to be aged. And Scotch connoisseurs had not had their fill of good Scotch during Prohibition. So Kennedy knew that once Prohibition was lifted, there would be a tremendous market from Scotch, which could only be gotten from Britain. So he went to Great Britain. He sailed. He took with him Jimmy Roosevelt, the president's son, and secured all the contracts to import the best Scotch into the United States in 1932, and made a very good living for the next 10 years.
Let's go ahead and make things clear, because you make it in your foreword, that this was a book that was initiated by the Kennedy family. How did this happen? And then because, of course, always the question is, well, then you're writing something really nice for the Kennedy family about their father, right?
Yeah. Well, the Kennedy family came to me and they said they wanted me to write this book. I met with Senator Kennedy in the Senate office building. The two of us and his two Portuguese water dogs, who were allowed to come to the Senate on Mondays because the Senate was not in session. And I said to the senator in a 3 or 4 hour conversation, I said over and over and over again, you don't want me to write this book. I'm a crazy, obsessive researcher. I'm going to find something the family doesn't like. And who knows, when this book comes out, there may be a Kennedy running for office, as indeed there was a Kennedy named Joseph P. Kennedy III. Senator Kennedy said to me, it's all out there. All the bad stuff is out there. We know you're a historian, and anything you write is going to be better than the garbage that's out there.
You know, the thing that amazed me is the amount of work that you must have gone through, because these folks, Joseph Kennedy particularly, was a letter writer. Did you read all those letters?
I read everything. Well, everything I could. Yeah. But, you know, what I told Senator Kennedy was that I would undertake this project, but I was not going to spend 6 years of my life if I thought there was any possibility that anybody was going to censor it. And I wanted in writing the family's agreement that they would not put any restrictions, any limitations on what I would see. And I wanted them to understand that they would see the book for the first time when it was in hardcover. I wouldn't show them any drafts. There'd be no censorship. And to its credit, the family agreed to my terms.
This is a famous man, a famous family. Did you uncover anything really new and something perhaps they didn't know?
I think I did. I think I uncovered a lot that was new. I uncovered, I don't know where to begin. His years, the financial papers had been locked away for years and years and years. So even the family didn't know the source of the income. They knew he hadn't been a bootlegger. I uncovered, because I had access to his financial records, where the money came from. He joined, as the youngest bank president, his father's tiny little bank in East Boston, the Columbia Trust Company, in 1925. And he used that bank as his piggy bank. Whenever he needed a loan to go into business, he took money from that. He began to build up a business in movies. He was a movie distributor in Boston. He tried to make the first movie with Babe Ruth. It didn't work.
And the affair with Gloria Swanson's pretty well known.
Yeah, that everybody knows about. But what people didn't know is when he gets to Hollywood, he demands to be paid in stock options. And then he manipulates those stock options. So instead of being paid, you know, a dollar in cash, he gets a stock option at a dollar. He drives up the price of that share from a dollar to $20, sells his option, and makes millions.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that, but I know people want to sort of fast forward. I tend to go chronologically, but we'd be here, if not for 6 years, then for more than 1 hour. But going into the era of when he becomes a supporter of FDR and then the ambassador to United Kingdom. I'm going to go to Lawrence's calling from Baden, because I think he wants to talk about that question of appeasement, neutrality, the thing that sort of hangs over Joseph P. Kennedy, and perhaps with good reason today. Lawrence, are you there?
Yes. He was an isolationist. I know he made some statements as ambassador that eventually angered Roosevelt. So I'd like you to discuss that. And I guess I got to ask this question. It's was he an anti-Semite in any way? Is there any evidence of that?
Yeah, two questions, and let's break it down into both, because I think we want to talk about the anti-Semitism in its own sense. But let's talk about the appeasement, Neville Chamberlain, and how he viewed Adolf Hitler, and how we might be able to deal with Hitler.
Yeah, I think the first thing to understand is that he was terribly afraid that if war came to Europe and if the United States entered that war, the economy would be destroyed. We would return to depression conditions. Democracy, capitalism would be threatened. Democracy would be threatened. So for him, anything was better than war. Anything was better than war. Let Hitler have what he wanted. Let's just not go to war. He was an appeaser. He was an isolationist. He did not want the United States to fight in Europe.
How representative was he of that view? Was he extreme in that view, or was that, you know, half the country at the
time? In the beginning, from 1938, 1939, early 1940, the country is against the war. The country agrees with him. They don't want isolation. They don't want us to intervene in a war as we had in World War One. As time goes on, and as it becomes clear to everyone except Joseph B. Kennedy that Hitler is a madman.
Even Neville Chamberlain sees that point.
Neville Chamberlain, the architect of the Munich Agreement, begins to understand you can't make a deal with Hitler. Kennedy still wants to make a deal, and Kennedy believes that if he has the opportunity to meet with Hitler, he can make a deal and he can settle all the problems that face the world. Up until the very last minute, he is against us entering a war, sending American boys to fight in Europe. And we have to remember, we get into the war because the Germans declare war on us, not because we declare war on them.
Did he view Hitler as just another businessman and you could sit down and make a deal, give him what he wants, trade a few things and make the deal?
His fear of war clouded his reason almost entirely. And he believed, yes, that as a businessman, he could sit down with Hitler. He could say, okay, what do you want? Here's what we want. In return for peace, we'll give you economic, we will help you rebuild the German economy. And he thought Hitler would agree to that.
Tom has a question, too, or a comment about that same era. He's calling from Afton. Tom?
Thank you. Yes, just before war was declared, you had the Spanish Civil War, and where the three great democracies, France, England, and the U.S., declared neutrality while Hitler tried out his new weapons and strategies against the Spanish people. And I've heard that Kennedy was a very strong supporter of neutrality on Spain. And the myth part of the question is this where some people believe the Kennedy curse came from, that he wanted us to stand by while, I guess, millions died in Spain, even before the war started?
We've got to put this into context. He was against entering the war in Spain in any way, but so was the majority of the American people, and so was the government. He begins to become the minority only much later, only really in the 1940s. Once Hitler attacks Luxembourg, Belgium, Norway, Denmark, France, once Hitler conquers Europe, everyone in this country is now ready to go to war. Joseph P. Kennedy is not.
We're talking to David Nassau, author of The Patriarch, a biography of Joseph P. Kennedy. You can join the conversation at 382-8255-TALK. That's 382-TALK. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. This is Jim Kircher filling in for Don Marsh today. My guest is David Nassau, author of the new biography of Joseph P. Kennedy, The Patriarch. We said we would deal with this issue of this question of anti-Semitism with Joseph Kennedy because, again, that is something that continues to define, I think, in our memories, who he was as perhaps one of his great flaws. There is this question, I think, of, let's put it in the context of the times. There is something that people call cultural anti-Semitism, which was sort of the accepted maybe country club anti-Semitism. How different is that from what Joseph Kennedy was feeling and doing?
Joseph Kennedy is not an anti-Semite like Henry Ford was an anti-Semite, or like I think St. Louis native Charles Lindbergh was. I think Lindbergh and Ford truly believed in a kind of racialist thinking that Jews are a separate race and there's something in their blood, in their genetic makeup.
A true racism.
Different. Yeah. I don't think Kennedy was that kind of a racist. Nonetheless, Kennedy, while he's in London and afterwards, buys into every anti-Semitic myth, the most horrible ones, the least rational ones. He believes that the Jews of the world have conspired together to push the United States into war.
And Roosevelt's Jews as well. I mean,
he believes that Washington is controlled by the Jews, by Brandeis Frankfurter, Rabbi Stephen Wise, Samuel Rosenman, that they control Roosevelt, that Hollywood is controlled by the Jews, that the press is controlled by the Jews, which is nonsense. William Randolph Hearst is not a Jew. And he believes that these forces are conspiring to push this nation into war, into a war the United States should not fight. And he becomes more and more angry, sort of virulently against this Jewish conspiracy. And his language begins to resemble that of Lindbergh, of Henry Ford. There's something just horrid, horrible about reading some of these letters, listening, you know, reading his diary. He is convinced that the Jews are out to destroy America by getting us into a war we can't win.
And yet he has Jewish friends and colleagues. He did make an effort, somewhat, I guess, to help Jewish refugees get out of Germany, but not to the United States.
No.
He thought that was England's problem.
Yeah, I think the fact that he's, you know, anti-Semitic doesn't mean that he wants the Jews to rot in Hitler's Third Reich. On the contrary, he tries to get them out. He knows, he invents the Kennedy Plan in 1939. He knows that the British aren't going to open up Palestine to let in the Jews because the British need the Arabs to fight Hitler when the war comes and Mussolini. So what he tries to do is to force the British to open up some other land, some other colonial territory in Africa or in South America to the Jews. He then thinks he can go and he can make a deal with Hitler. He can say to Hitler, look, you need loans, you need currency, you need gold, you need dollars. We'll give it to you. Let the Jews go.
This was the business deal he thought he could make with yeah. Hitler. One of the things I think that surprised me, and I think some of the reviews have been very positive about this aspect of the book, in one sense, he may be the worst possible person to make an ambassador or, let's say, a diplomat.
Yeah.
He did not understand what that role was supposed to be.
No. It was a dreadful decision by Roosevelt. Roosevelt thinks that because Kennedy is so smart and is such a keen observer and writes well, he thinks Roosevelt's going to be his eyes and ears in Europe. Roosevelt's going to let him know exactly what's going on over there. What he doesn't understand is that Kennedy is so afraid of war and so committed to appeasement and isolation that he runs his own foreign policy. He doesn't follow orders. He does what he thinks is necessary.
And speaks out.
He speaks out, but he does other things as well. He meets clandestinely with representatives of Goering. He meets clandestinely with German representatives and German diplomats to try to get himself invited to Berlin so he can make a deal with Hitler. The problem is that Roosevelt should have brought him back after he had been there for 2 weeks. But Roosevelt needs him because Roosevelt is going to run for election in 1940. And he needs the support of Kennedy, who is the most popular, influential, politically connected Irish-American, Irish-Catholic in the country.
And some people have talked about him as a presidential candidate.
In 1938, 1939, there begins to be a boom for Kennedy, if Roosevelt doesn't run again in 1940, that Kennedy, people think, is a likely candidate.
Mark is calling from St. Louis. Mark?
Really looking forward to reading your book. You know, there are so many potent reasons that you've given to explain why, in the mind of Joe Kennedy, he did not want us to get in the war and that he's an isolationist. But I wonder, could one of the reasons have been that he was Irish? Because isolationism and neutrality was a very common view in the Irish Republic. You know, he was still very close to Ireland, and the Irish had always seen England's wars as Ireland's opportunity, and they had always hated the fact that so many Irish men had died in English colonial wars. Do you think there was any residual Hibernianism in his love of isolationism?
Yes, there had to be. That's a very intelligent question and a very good question. Yes, there's no doubt that he was against World War I, and he did everything he possibly could to stay out. He did not want, like many, many, many Irish Americans, he did not want to save the British Empire. And he thought that's what the British wanted. Certainly, he believed in World War II. That's what Churchill wanted. And he was not going to spend a dollar of American money or shed American blood to save the British Empire.
One of the things I think that gets pointed out is even as the RAF is winning the Battle of Britain, he's thinking it's a problem.
Yeah. We've got to remember one thing, and that's during the Battle of Britain, the Soviet Union has not entered the war yet. So the Germans can have only one enemy. They've defeated everybody except Britain. No one, certainly not Kennedy, believes that if the Germans want to conquer Britain, they can't do it. The question is, how are they going to do it? How long is it going to take them? Kennedy hoped that there would be a quick defeat of Great Britain and peace. Instead, the RAF fights back the Luftwaffe almost to a stalemate, and to the point where Hitler decides he can't invade anymore. For Kennedy, this is a disaster. It's a tragedy because all it means is that the war will go on and on and on and on, and England will still be defeated.
Let's talk about the children, because he loses his oldest son in World War II. That has to have not an impact only on his personal life, but also perhaps on his politics. How significant of a turning point is that in his life?
It's a frightening moment in his life, and he's never the same man again. He had opposed this war with every ounce of his will, his intelligence, his power, his political power. The war comes to pass. He's not going to oppose the war once the Americans are in it, so he keeps quiet. In 1944, after D-Day, his son is killed. And he writes letters in response to the condolences he receives. And he says to his friends, how ironic is it that the war that I tried to stop came to pass, and it took away not only my oldest son, but he didn't think Jack would ever recover. Jack would ever be the same. When Jack came back from the South Pacific in his PT boat, he was so thin, so frail, he went directly into the hospital and stayed there for a long period of time. Kennedy was devastated, and he said to himself over and over again, and to friends and to anyone who would listen, why did we fight this war? Hitler's defeated, but instead of having Hitler ruling Europe, we're not going to have the Soviet Union. What have we gained?
Our guest today is David Nassau, author of The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy. One of the things, again, as a baby boomer who identifies with JFK, I guess I didn't realize just how sickly this man was as a young man. He did not look to be in the making of a prominent individual necessarily.
No, his father never believed that he would succeed in politics or even be able to enter politics. Jack Kennedy caught every childhood disease imaginable and a couple of others. He may hold the world's record for the last rites being performed. He had a bad back, a bad stomach, Addison's disease. He probably caught malaria in the South Pacific. He was skinny as a rail. He was always coming down with these mysterious high fevers. His fever would spike to 104, 105. He'd be rushed into a hospital. The last rites would be performed. And miraculously, he'd come out of it. He looked awful. And one of the reasons he was a good president was that he was a voracious reader during his childhood because he spent so much time in bed recovering from one disease or the other.
There's still a lot of people who spend a lot of time on the JFK conspiracies. How much of that reflects back on what people think about Joseph Kennedy? I wonder if some of the JFK conspiracies sort of backdate to – I wonder if some of the mythology is more modern perhaps than we think.
That's a very good observation, and you're absolutely right. When in 1960, the Nixon people – who are running against Jack Kennedy, they do all the research they can to dig up all the dirt they can on the father. And they dig up a lot of dirt. What they don't dig up is anything about bootlegging. There's no mention of bootlegging. the FBI investigates Joe Kennedy five, six, seven times for all his different government appointments. They never come up with any suspicion that he's a bootlegger or that he's tied to organized crime. It is only later when the conspiracy buffs, when the conspiracy writers and historians are trying to tie the mob to the assassination and the Kennedy family to the mob, that all of these stories come out of the woodwork about Joe Kennedy being a bootlegger and having mafia connections. It only surfaces really in the late 60s, early 70s.
Call in your questions. We're at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Email is stlpublicradio.org. Let's go back a little bit because the part about how he made his money. This was a brilliant guy who managed to make money, take his profits, as opposed to try to make a killing, I guess, did insider trading, as you point out, when insider trading was perfectly legal, and then became head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. But as some of those, how he made his fortune, some of it's a little shady and yet maybe not technically illegal.
He knew the market. Again, this is an incredibly smart guy and a guy who's good with numbers. And he understands, he plays the borders, he plays the boundaries. He goes as far as he possibly could without going into illegal territory.
And he knows where that is.
He knows exactly where it is. And he does all sorts of every trick of the trade. He forms pools. He sells short. He does lots and lots of insider trading. He sells and buys stock in the companies that he's a director of. He knows exactly what's going on. He has 10, 20 different accounts in 10 or 20 different names that he sells so people don't know that it's him. He spreads rumors when he wants a stock to go up or down. Every trick in the trade. Then Roosevelt names him to be the first chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And Kennedy, by now, Kennedy is scared, frightened by the Depression. And he believes that unless confidence is restored in capitalism, American capitalism is going to be in bad shape, and the country may very well go in the direction of Italy or Germany or the Soviet Union, away from capitalism and democracy. So faith and confidence in the market has to be restored, and he knows the only way to do that is to outlaw all the tricks of the trade that he had indulged in. He spends 15 months as the first chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. When he leaves, he stops trading in stocks and bonds. Why? Because he's outlawed every device that he used to make his millions. He puts his money into real estate instead.
He did serve his country, and I think you make the point that the famous John Kennedy quote, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country," really comes from that family, those family lessons.
Yeah, he tells his kids and anybody else who wants to listen over and over and over again that the reason he's made all this money is so that his kids won't have to. He leaves them all, and the grandchildren too, huge trust funds. And he tells them over and over and over again at the dinner table, whenever they have a conversation, look, I've left you this money, not so that you can be the idle rich, but so that you can do something with your life, so that you can enter public service. And they do. They do. The women as well as the men. I mean, the stories about Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who founds the disability rights movement, about Jean Kennedy Smith, who was the ambassador to Ireland during the time in which the Northern Ireland problem is solved. I mean, the women as well as the men go into public service as their father wanted and do good work.
Richard is calling from St. Louis. I think he wants to talk about those days in London. Richard?
Oh, thank you, sir. This is quite, your book is very magnetic. But my question is, and I have read the book of Beschloff and the Hamilton book about John Kennedy in his early years, and there's a lot in there on Joe. But my question is, he was there when the submarine warfare, 39, 40, and 41, And my question is, did he have a naval attaché, or did he have a lot of contact with U.S. naval people about exactly how superior the German submarine warfare was? Because there are some naval reports that are very dark about eventually England being cut off and the North Atlantic being controlled by German submarines. And Kennedy seems to be totally unaware of some of the technical and naval strategic issues.
Dave. Yeah, he gets most of his information. He has naval attachés, he has army attachés, and he's very close to Lindbergh. So he gets a lot of his information from Lindbergh.
And Lindbergh is warning that the German military and air power is just overwhelming.
There's no way that he believes that the English can, you know, survive a German attack. Kennedy, though he's an isolationist and an appeaser, believes that the Americans should beef up their own defenses. And he wants the American Navy, the Coast Guard, the Air Force to protect American borders, to make sure, to put up make an arsenal of America so that the Germans can never attack over here. He knows, he's pretty good on what's going on. He underestimates, however, British resolve. He believes the British will just cave in to the superior power immediately, and he can't believe that the British keep fighting.
Lots more ground to cover. We'll do that in a moment. Our phone number is 382-8255. Our guest is David Nassau, author of the new biography of Joseph P. Kennedy. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. This is Jim Kircher filling in for Don Marsh today, talking about the life and legacy of Joseph P. Kennedy with the author of a new biography, David Nassau. I read with a lot of interest sort of the jousting between FDR and Kennedy. I think Joseph Kennedy may have met his match in Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but I'm not sure he knew it.
No, he didn't know it. Kennedy always believed himself the smartest man in the room, whoever was in the room, and most of the time he was. He was a charmer. I remember when one of my first conversations with Ted Kennedy, the senator would tell me how he would watch his father as a child walk into a room of strangers, and within 2 minutes, people were gravitating to him. It was like he had a magnetic field that drew people in. People wanted to know him, to talk to him, to be his friend. Roosevelt was the same way, but Roosevelt was even more of a charmer. When Roosevelt turned on his charm, you couldn't say no to him. And Roosevelt was the president. So though Roosevelt needed Kennedy's support, Kennedy, if he was going to go anywhere in public service, and if he was going to prepare the way for his children to go into public service, needed Roosevelt more than Roosevelt needed him. And Roosevelt was even more cunning, shrewder in personal politics.
Let's talk about JFK and the role that his father might have played or didn't play in his career. And certainly one of the stories is buying elections.
I think those of us who are fathers, if we had a lot of money and if we want, you know, if there were any chance that our kids would be president, we do everything we possibly could to help him out. Joe Kennedy did that, and I don't think he should be faulted for it.
And I guess the question in buying elections would be distinguishing between funding a campaign and buying votes.
Well, in West Virginia, everybody bought votes.
In the 1960 primary. Right?
Everybody bought votes in the primaries. The question, you know, Humphrey tried to buy votes, but he didn't have as much money as Kennedy. Elsewhere, Kennedy didn't buy votes. He didn't need to. I mean, there are all these stories about him buying the election in Illinois in 1960. Well, he didn't need to. Mayor Richard Daley was in Illinois, and he was going to control the election in ways he had much more influence and power than Kennedy had, and Kennedy knew it. Kennedy's major role was to bankroll his son's campaigns, and his son always had more money, much more money, 2-3 times more money than any candidate he ran against. That's number one. That's where we start. But number two, Kennedy is really smart, Joe Kennedy, the father, about television. Kennedy's grown up in Hollywood. Kennedy knows how to manipulate images. Kennedy knows how to make a good appearance before the newsreel cameras. Kennedy makes sure his kids grow up poised in front of cameras. All the nannies take pictures of the kids, moving pictures from the time they're toddlers. Jack Kennedy appears before the newsreel cameras from the times he's 16 years old. And Kennedy teaches him exactly how to smile, how to look, what to say, how to comb his hair. It is no accident that in 1960, in the debates with Nixon, Nixon looks, speaks well, but looks terrible. Kennedy looks great. He looks poised. He looks friendly. He speaks directly to the camera and to the audience. It was his father who taught him that.
Yeah, he's often considered the first media-savvy candidate. I know Eisenhower worked with, Robert Montgomery or somebody, and Adlai Stevenson was working on stuff, but Kennedy really nailed it. And you're saying this goes back to the Hollywood days.
It goes back to the Hollywood days, and from 1946 on, Kennedy knows before anybody else how important television is going to be as a campaign tool. And he prepares his son from 1946 on. In every campaign, his son does more television and better television than anybody else.
We're at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We're talking to David Nassau, author of the new biography of Joseph P. Kennedy. I guess during those campaigns, though, when Jack Kennedy has to set out on his own to be his own man, his father needs to step aside a little bit because he is a volatile character and maybe something of a political burden to him.
The family arrives at a decision, and Kennedy agrees with it. He prompts that decision that he's going to disappear. He's going to go into exile. From 1946 on, there are no pictures, no campaign pictures anywhere. There's one from 1946 of Kennedy and his son. He doesn't go to any of his son's campaign appearances. He doesn't listen to any speeches. He never gives interviews. He bows out entirely because he wants the focus to be on his son. And because Jack is always looks so young, the temptation is to think that the father is telling the younger man what to say and how to say it. That's not true. Jack Kennedy becomes his own man very early and surrounds himself with a group of advisors and makes his own policies.
Right. And again, for those of us who didn't grow up in that era, we're not necessarily familiar with just how famous and powerful a figure Joseph Kennedy was for the general public. I mean, again, we think of him as JFK's and Bobby's and Teddy's father, but they saw Jack as Joe's son.
It took a while for Jack. In the 1960 campaign, there were four problems that Jack faced. One, he looked too young. Two, he had a famous father who nobody really liked. Three, he looked sickly, and there were rumors that he was sick. And four, he was a Roman Catholic. In the end, only number four stood out. He campaigned so often that people forgot. I mean, nobody could have been unhealthy who campaigned the way he did. Joe Kennedy kept away, so, you know, nobody thought about that. And he was only – Nixon was a young man, and the Kennedy campaign made it clear that the difference between the two of them was not very much. The problem was the Irish Catholicism. And in 1960, boy, we've come a long way since 1960 – in 1960, the fact that a candidate for president was Irish Catholic was the main issue in the campaign for a long, long time.
And here was something I learned from reading the book. It was how angry Joe Kennedy was that the Catholic Church didn't stand up for his son and say, vote for this guy. That's a complicated and complex issue going on.
It was remarkable. And this is something I found that nobody had ever found by looking at Kennedy's letters. Kennedy believed that the Catholic Church was going to support his boy. Now, the Catholic Church wasn't going to say, you know, the priests weren't going to say vote for Jack. They were going to say register. They were going to say make sure your neighbors are registered. They were going to say go out and vote. They were going to say, you know, campaign for the candidate of your choice. They were going to do everything they could to get out the Irish Catholic vote. The opposite was the case. The church hierarchy did not want Jack Kennedy to be elected president. They thought Nixon was more of an anti-communist. They thought Nixon would be more likely to support their two major agenda items, which were aid to parochial schools and establishing diplomatic relationships with the Vatican.
And there's no way John Kennedy could come out in favor of aid to parochial schools.
You know, he can't do it. He can't do it. Nixon didn't do it either.
Right.
But the most important issue, I think, is that the Catholic Church doesn't want this vibrant young guy to be the face of American Catholicism. They'd much prefer that Cardinal Spellman be the most visible, the most important Catholic in the country.
When you read history, one of the most interesting things, I think, is how current it sounds. A lot of the issues, I think, with Kennedy and Catholicism were the same issues with Obama being the first African-American candidate or president. Was he black enough for some people? Was he not black? Was he too black for other people? And I think Kennedy sort of faced the same thing with Catholicism. Is this the Catholic we want? Is he the right guy?
It was, you know, in the end, the political scientists, when the election's over, as we're seeing right now, the political scientists take apart every precinct, every district. They discovered that the Democrats, if you tallied all the votes in Congress for the congressional candidates, the Democrats got 54.5% of the votes. In the presidential election, Kennedy got 49.8% of the votes. There was a fall off of 5%. The only way to figure where that came from was Protestant whites who usually voted Democratic and voted Democratic in their local elections would not vote for this man. Why? Because he was Irish Catholic.
The other thing is, I look at Joe Kennedy, he supported a lot of Catholic causes and charities. He sort of thought he was due, that his son was due this. It was sort of a quid pro quo business deal
in some ways. It was a quid pro quo, but it was also a feeling that this is good for Catholics in this country. This will, if we get a Catholic president, this will eliminate a lot of the prejudice that we're, you know, a separate people, that we're a different people. He was right in that. But the Catholic Church didn't see it that way. They did not want this man to be the first Catholic president.
Let's talk a little bit about the inside, the social stuff. We'll dig a little dirt. Charles is calling from St. Louis, and we'll talk about some of his affairs, I think. Charles?
Good morning. Yes, my question is, I understand that Joseph Kennedy had quite a few affairs with a variety of young women. And did he have any illegitimate children? And how did his wife take this, given that she probably knew about it? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, this stuff's in the book, by the way, in case you want to buy it.
Thank you. No, there were no illegitimate children. I mean, Kennedy was very, he watched out and made sure that there were no illegitimate children. That's number one. Number two, he and Rose early on came to an agreement that was very much like the agreement Rose's father had made with Rose's mother. And that was that Kennedy would lead a separate life. There would be other women in that life, but he would do nothing ever to embarrass Rose. Nothing so that she would have to say to herself or to him, what are you doing? They led separate lives for the most part. And Rose was able to convince herself, or at least to appear as if her husband was a faithful husband, though she had to know. She led a life with blinders on. You know, she didn't look at what she didn't want to see.
And yet his children considered him to be a great and wonderful father, even though he wasn't always there.
His children loved him, admired him, respected him. He was a terrific father. When he was away from home, he would write each of the kids a separate letter. He would write 9 separate letters to the kids. He knew everything about them. He knew who their best friends were and how they were getting along in school and what their favorite sports were, and doted over all of them. And they loved him for it. And they forgave him these other women in part because their mothers seem to have forgiven him.
And his sons, to some extent, followed in his path as well.
They certainly did. Certainly Jack did. Yeah. Certainly Jack's promiscuity was following in the example of his father's.
John's calling from St. Louis. John, go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. This is an excellent conversation. I would like to ask the author if he wants to clarify an impression that he at least left with me with a statement that he had made earlier to the effect that isolationist sentiment had pretty much disappeared in the United States after Hitler had conquered Europe. This, I think, goes contrary to some historical facts. For example, the America First Committee wasn't formed until September of 1940 and only disbanded, thankfully, after Pearl Harbor. Gerald Nye addressed a meeting in Pittsburgh on December 7th. He was the senator from North Dakota. And he had been told before his speech that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. He had that confirmed during his speech, but he didn't mention it at all until the very end when he said something to the effect of, "I've just received the worst news that I've heard in the last 20 years." And to his credit, he supported the war effort. But I don't think that isolationist sentiment disappeared.
Go ahead.
No, until David, after December 7th.
No, right, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. What changes only is that in 39-40, Americans begin to believe that it's necessary to aid the British and to send them all material help, but not to enter the war. That kind of isolationism changes. But you're absolutely right. Americans did not want to go into the war, certainly the war in Europe. And again, we can never forget that it is the Germans after Pearl Harbor who declare war on the United States. I don't know if Roosevelt ever would have declared war on the Germans had they not done it first. You're absolutely right that isolationism remained a very strong current in this country through 1940.
I want to recognize one of our listeners pointed out that Charles Lindbergh was not a native St. Louisan. But I do believe his father, who was a congressman, was also an isolationist and quit Congress because of World War I. So the isolationism with Charles Lindbergh started well into his family. And in the last couple of minutes that we have left, I want to talk about the Kennedy family today, the legacy. The three sons are gone. Joe Kennedy lost a daughter. He had another daughter who he lost because of the mental illness and the lobotomy. But today, you talked about his concern that his kids didn't turn into the idle rich. Are the Kennedys still having an impact today, or have they turned into the idle rich?
No, I think they are having an impact. The Shriver family continues to run. All of the Shriver kids have done enormous work for the mentally disabled. And the other kids all over are doing public work. I mean, they take very seriously the lesson of their parents. And the lesson of their parents was, you've got all this money, you're lucky, you're fortunate, give something back to those who don't have the benefits that you were born with.
David Nassau, thank you for joining us. He's the author of The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy. Thanks so much for being here. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll be talking with political journalist and author George Will. Baseball may come up in the conversation. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. I'm Jim Kircher.